ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and it is my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road, down the Smoky Mountains, and shares wrestling history with every one of us each and every week. And of course, before we get going any further, let me introduce him right now, the man of the hour, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you
today? I'm great, Brian. Real pleasure to be here as always, and got a good one today. Going to do a lot of different, we're going in a lot of different directions, and horses all saddled up. And I'm ready to ride whenever you are, my man.
Well, we'll get going in just 1 second, but right here at the top of the show, I do want to make mention of the brand new, the latest Super Studcast number 19 with Dirty Dutch Mantel. Hear all about Dirty Dutch Mantel's career, how he broke into the business, how he got the name Dutch Mantel. Hear stories about riots, Japan, and of course, the whole story about what went down in July of 1988 in Puerto Rico, the murder of Bruiser Brody. This is a Super Studcast that will go down in the books as one of the greatest ones we've ever done. There's lots of laughs. There's lots of moments that make you stop and think. And I think everyone should check this out. Of course, the Super Studcast is always available, as all episodes of the Super Studcast are, at patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. Only $2.99. Gets you in the door, and there is just so much content. We'll tell you a little bit more about it later in the show. But Ron, heading into this show here today, we have a lot of things you're going to get to, and I want you to tell us where we're going today, but we also didn't get to finish everything we wanted to talk about last week.
Yeah, and I think that's where we'll start this week, is we had a lot of things on our schedule for the last program, and obviously we didn't get to them. So we're going to go back and complete last week's show, beginning with the May 23rd, 1975 card in Knoxville at Chilhowie Park Amphitheater. And this is going to be the first Southeastern wrestling card that the new TV station, WBIR, promoted on the very first ever Southeastern wrestling TV show on their station. We're going to also talk about some very good talent set up in advance of the summer of 1975. We're going to update the $1,000 lawsuit situation I just received on the last episode. We're also going to look at the May 30th, 1975 card and TV show to promote it. And finally, if time allows us to, talk about something we've never discussed in the 2 years that the Studscast have been on the air. So we're going to do something at the end of today's program we've never done before, basically. And so I'm curious to see how fans are going to like that. I'm just ready to roll with it, my man. Whenever you are, this should be a great one, and a whole lot of stuff in this one.
Well, let's roll with it, and let's start today where we ended last week, like you said earlier. Let's get the results of the May 23rd, 1975 card in Knoxville. This was at Chilhowie Park's Amphitheater, and once again, this was the very first Southeastern wrestling show you had a chance to promote on WBIR, your new television station.
That's correct. And actually, the week before May 23rd, on Friday, May 16th, we did have rain, and we had to move indoors to the little Chilhowie Park Arena. But on May 23rd, it's no rain. It's a beautiful night. And And we're also on that card for the first time ever in Southeastern history. We're going to put 7 matches on that card at Chilhowee Park for that event. And first and second matches were really great matches. I'm always a big stickler about that first match. Actually, the first two are great matches because I have the Mongolian Stomper managed by Bearcat Wright, and he's going to wrestle in both those matches. He's going to beat 2 different opponents back-to-back, but he's going to go back to the dressing room after the first one and then come back when they ring the bell again. So it's a very rare appearance, and he has not been in the building in Knoxville since the Coliseum show. And so the duos, these two guys, Bearcat Wright and Mongolian Stomper, are top talent anywhere in the world at this point. And it says a lot for this card for them to be on not just the first match, but back again for the second match. So the Stomper is an extremely impressive guy and in this first match on that card, he really takes care of Jerry Bryant, who's a young kid just trying to get his start. And Stomper really puts it to him. In fact, I watched that match and I remember him stomping him right in the face. So like it kind of reminded me of the Dale Lewis stomp of the guy that got me in such trouble and with a challenge match. But and then he comes back in the second match and he does it to Tommy Rich, same thing. So, but what he does something this night that's really different. I hadn't seen him do before. After his match, his first match, when he stomps Jerry Bryant in the face and he leaves the ring, he charges the ringsiders and creates some pandemonium. Chairs go flying in all direction, and he panics them he's trying to be controlled by Bearcat Wright during this point, but Bearcat's not doing such a great job. And he goes, instead of between the sections of ringside back to the dressing room, he goes through one section. And, all the fans are just running everywhere and chairs are flying. And then when he comes back for the second match, he quickly takes care of Tommy Rich. And this time he leaves the ring again and Bearcat again can't control him. But he sets his sight on the huge general admission grandstand this time. And he jumps down from the raised surface where the ringside and the ringsiders sit and where the ring sits. Into the grandstand. The grandstand is huge there, probably seats 4,000 plus. And there's probably about 2,500 people there that night in the grandstand. And he charges up into the grandstand. Wow. I mean, it's like pandemonium again. I mean, I got concerned. I watched the thing in the grandstand. I got like, wow, somebody's going to get hurt here. So, I had to say that, he made a horrifying impression on the fans. Considering, like I said, it was only his second time, and 4 weeks earlier he was there for that Coliseum show. This is only his second time back there. This is going to be the first of 5 straight shows that he's going to work in Knoxville, and it was the type of fan reaction that every promoter and owner of a wrestling company really want to see. I mean, it normally takes about 6 wins on TV for a heel to start even getting over a little bit. And the Mongolian Stomper proved basically it could be done in just one night. I mean, he really got himself over in that night.
Ron, you hear a lot of stories about Bearcat Wright at different times, maybe being a little difficult with promoters. Did you have any issues with Bearcat Wright?
Never did, but I did not do a whole lot of business with him. Bear in mind that Stomper and Bearcat are working for Jerry Jarrett, Memphis, at this point, and they're just coming over and working for me on Fridays sometime. And it's my first impression and my first time to work much with Bearcat Wright and also Stomper. I really didn't know Stomper very much at this point either. So I never had any problem with either one of them. And I think they're going to have some problems with Jarrett down the line here. It's pretty difficult. Stomper is pretty well known in the business as being a difficult guy. And so I was lucky that I had a great relationship, and I was even more lucky that he loved the Smoky Mountains. And once he came there, he never wanted to leave. In fact, he never left, as a matter of fact.
Hey, one more question about this, Ron, and that is, of course, one of the two guys that he beats here is Tommy Rich. We talked about him a few weeks back on the show, but Did you see anything in Tommy Rich this early on that would lead you to believe he would become the level of superstar he would become just a few years later in Atlanta?
Yes, I did see. I did see something different in Tommy Rich. And it was basically his comeback, you know, and that's what he was really known for. That's how he got the nickname Wildfire. And a lot of that, I'm going to be honest with you, I think came from Nick Gulas, strangely enough, because Nick Gulas, Tommy worked out of Nashville, and he was working sometimes for Jarrett. Sometimes he'd work for Gulas. Sometimes he'd be sent to Knoxville from Jarrett. Jarrett would send him over there on a Friday night. But Nick was always big at pushing his young wrestlers to fire back, sell great, but make tremendous comebacks with a lot of fire. And I believe that he really had an effect, a pretty much profound effect on old Tommy, because Tommy really had fire from the very beginning. At this point in 1975, when he's wrestling Stomper that night, he's probably in his first or second year, and he's already got that fire. And I was really impressed with that. And that's really what makes his reputation for him. He has that tremendous fiery comeback, and fans love that, obviously.
What was the next match on the show, Ron?
The third match was Jimmy Golden against the Knoxville newcomer, George McCrary. And I had brought George in because I had worked with him in Florida before I bought Knoxville. And he had a very good amateur background, McCrary did, and for a heel. And he did a lot of wrestling in all of his matches. I was still focused on wrestling and the education of my fans about wrestling, and the exact opposite, basically, of the matches that the Stomper had just had in those first two matches. You know, Stomper didn't do a whole lot of wrestling, I can tell you that. McCrary comes out and wrestles, has a great wrestling match with Jimmy Golden. He's a very likable guy. But like a lot of the amateur wrestlers in the sport, he's never going to become a great worker. And I don't understand how that happens all the time. But there are a lot of times that a great amateur background doesn't always transfer to a great professional wrestling back, you know. So McCrary, you know, like Stomper, McCrary also, he was also going to be on the next five shows for me. And it was certainly not going to generate the horror and interest of the fans like the Mongolian Stomper is. But he's going to give me good matches. He's going to give me a lot of wrestling. He's a fairly decent little heel. You know, he's not one of those guys that you can put a lot on his back and expect him to carry the load and be able to draw you big money. Jimmy obviously gets another win here with a fantastic drop kick, and I watched that match too. And gosh, Jimmy sometimes just had these drop kicks that were just so beautiful. And he kicked McCrary with both feet in the face. It looked like it took his head off. It was just beautiful. So that was another great match. And we're off to a great start for the night. Now we had the two wild matches with Stomper. Now we've had a great wrestling match, in which a drop kick is the finish. And then we go into the fourth match, which is Jerry Jarrett versus Sam Bass, the manager of Ron and Don Bass, who are the Tennessee tag champions. Sam Bass is a very good worker for a manager. You don't see managers work very often, to be honest. And they use Sam quite a bit in the ring as well as a manager. And that's pretty, very, very unusual. And he had a great match with Jarrett that night. And Jerry won the match. Jarrett won the match. And so as we push on through, the next two matches were both championship matches. Fifth match was for the Tennessee Tag Championship with champions Ron and Don Bass versus Ron and Don Wright. And that's an odd situation there. You got Ron and Don against Ron and Don. But as you would imagine, it was a wild affair as usual with these four, especially the Wrights. Anytime the two Wrights were in the ring, I don't care whether they're baby faces or heels, they're going to create some havoc there. Sam Bass again saves his team, their belts, by getting involved, and he got his team disqualified, as he did on a lot of occasions, to keep from losing the belts. And all five of these guys are going to return in the special eight-man tag, which is the last match on this card.
Is there a match before the eight-man tag?
Yes, I'm going to be in the sixth match. And I said there were seven matches on this card for the first time ever in Chill Alley Park. And I'm defending my Southern title against another newcomer on this card, Ricky Gibson. And Ricky's only had 1 week here at this point. And we had a great wrestling match for the first 20 minutes. And then the style of the match kind of changed greatly when I got him bleeding. And Ricky was one of those guys that bled profusely, kind of like Joe LaDuke, Abdullah the Butcher, Dusty sometimes. The fans were into the wrestling part of the match, but boy, they went wild when the blood started flowing. And Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson were going to soon become tag partners in the territory. So Jimmy came down and he pulled Gibson out of the ring, a very bloody Ricky Gibson, out of the ring before I could pin him. And Ricky was a great seller and always got the crowd on their feet because he never quit. He sailed, but he would fight back. He really had a lot of heart. And he fought back so well in these type of matches, it just really made this match something more than I expected it was going to be. And at this point, nobody knew Jimmy was my cousin. So when the referee counted out, still fighting Gibson out there, Jimmy, he's fighting Jimmy actually to get back to me. And Jimmy's trying to get him to the dressing room because he's so bloody. He's down to his tights and he's just covered. And even Jimmy did his best to drag him toward the dressing room. And I got my hand raised. Obviously, he's out there on the floor and I've won the match. So when Golden got his back turned to me and he's trying to push Ricky back into the dressing room, then I sneak up on Jimmy from behind and I nail him with a chair to the back of his head. And I drag Jimmy back to the ring and Gibson is down at this point. And another couple of wrestlers come out, baby faces, and they drag him back into the dressing room. And I throw Jimmy into the ring and I get in and begin to whip a second opponent. And now Jimmy's tag partner, Jerry Jarrett, back in the dressing room there. He's had his single match that night, but he's partners with Jimmy for several weeks. He comes running in the ring and he starts on me. And then Sam Bass, who had lost to Jarrett in that earlier match, sees what's going on and he comes down to the ring and he gets in. And the fans at this point, since I got Gibson bloody, they've never stopped screaming. They're standing on their feet all throughout the whole amphitheater. And then when Ron Wright comes down, every arrival into the ring, that crowd noise gets higher. And then Ron Bass comes, Don Wright comes, and then Don Bass. And now finally the whole 8-man tag is in the ring, and there's going to be no bell. There will be bells and introduction. But nobody's going to care at this point. We're all fighting already. The bell hasn't been rung. In fact, there's no referees there until all eight of us get to the ring. So both referees, they hit the ring at that point, and they start ringing the bell, and they start trying to denounce the contestants. And they do, but you can't hear. I mean, the crowd is really roaring at this point, and I don't think anybody could hear any of the intros over the roar. And then I don't think they cared about the intros. Everyone's on their feet and screaming. And you couldn't have heard a word if another wrestler had screamed as loud as he could right in your face. You could not have heard him. It's one of those moments in which the crowd just they drone out everything. It went probably 10 minutes with action inside and outside the ring before the referees had enough because they were getting manhandled by all eight of us. They'd all been knocked down two or three times, and they just said, that's it. They started ringing the bell. They disqualified everybody involved. But the fight didn't stop. We continued after the bell, and we fought in the ringside area close to the dressing rooms, and a couple of guys, two pairs of guys, were down in the actual general admission grandstand area. Pandemonium was just it was just wild there, and it was exactly the way any promoter would have loved to see his crowd at the end of a night. Fans going crazy and wrestlers fighting all over the place. I mean, that's a great way to end a show, and it really, I thought, was a good night for us.
Well, based on the descriptions of the matches you just gave, it sounds like it was a pretty successful night for you. Did anything happen that night that didn't please you?
Well, the box office receipts were not what I would have liked to have had. The crowd was larger than the Friday before. But bear in mind, Friday before, we were inside in a smaller building in the park because it had rained. So I expected the crowds to be down for a while because the TV show had changed in every way. Not just the time that it aired, but more importantly, even the station that it normally aired on. So in a way, by leaving one station and going to a new television station, it was like starting a new territory with a TV that had only been on for 1 week. The actual attendance was probably around 3,000, but if we hadn't have changed TV stations, I think that crowd would have been closer to 4,000, maybe even above 4,000. I was not too upset by the attendance because I really kind of figured ahead of time that when I change these stations, it's going to take a while for the audience to find us. And we really worked hard on publicizing it, but it's still going to take some time. So I wasn't too upset with attendance. I couldn't afford to be because my reaction to the crowds in the future would be closely watched by the wrestlers. The boys watch the promoters, and they get into feel for whether he thinks it's a good house or a bad house. They get a lot from looking at it and keeping a close eye on the promoter. I don't think hardly any of them even considered the effect that changing the television stations was going to have on the attendance. As a booker, promoter, or owner, your attitude was always being assessed by the talent. I knew the attendance would drop at first when we changed TV station, but then I expected it to slowly rise in the first few weeks of the new TV. But I never spoke to anyone about it. I didn't talk to guys about, well, guys, we may need to expect a smaller crowd. That's the last thing you want to tell the wrestlers, So it was just me that had that thought process going. And I don't think that really bothered the wrestlers that much. Realistically, I really couldn't be too upset because I got to thinking less than 7 months earlier when I arrived in Knoxville, crowds were only between 1,000 and 2,000. And I'm sitting here with 3,000 plus people, and I'm not going to get upset by that.
In terms of the talent you're using, it seems like you pretty much have a situation with Jerry Jarrett now where you're working there and then you have access to his talent.
Yes. Yeah. Since we're talking about the talent, yeah, and I do have access to some of his talent. And at the same time, he has occasionally access to some of my talent. Like I said, Ron and Don Wright, when we took that first airplane ride. That's a situation where some of my people were going over there. Actually, Dale Lewis was going over there quite a bit, and he was living in Knoxville and working for me. So we had been swapping some talent. But since we're talking about the talent on the card, we now had a really fantastic wrestling show format and layout. My next task was really to get the best wrestlers I could find to be on the show in the summer of 1975. If I could get them on that type of wrestling show and I had great talent, I knew that I was going to have success. I had a feeling that Jerry Jarrett and my swapping of talent to add stars to each of our towns was not a practical way to expect things to continue. He was not going to use me on top in Memphis as an example forever. I knew that. And I knew where he wasn't going to make his wrestlers available to me on Friday nights forever. I didn't know when this was going to end, but I knew that it was soon to end probably. I had to fill the holes in my talent level, and I had to do it now at that point. Luckily, summer was the best time of the year attendance-wise. And that's going to give me a better chance to survive an anticipated shortage of talent from Jared. I'm anticipating it, that it's going to happen, and I'm out there on the phone and really trying to dig up some good talent for the summer of 75.
Did Jared get any heat for working with you, considering you had gotten out of the agreement with your grandfather and Nick, and obviously you and Nick had no love for each other?
No, I don't think Jared got any heat. Jared, at this point, he's not an owner. He's basically booking and kind of handling Memphis. That Tennessee territory is two distinctly different territories. What Nick ran was Nick's towns, and what Jared was working in were Roy's towns. The western side of the state and in Louisville belonged to basically Roy. And Nick had Birmingham and involved in Chattanooga and Nashville. He had his own towns. So it was a strange situation, that Tennessee territory. So I got on my horse and I started tracking down some new talent. And I, like I said, I already had brought in Ricky Gibson as a babyface, and he had worked on the last show and he worked with me on this show. I had the Mongolian Stomper and George McCrary. They're going to work the next 5 weeks into the first part of the summer of 75, as well as the old great veteran Sputnik Monroe is going to be on a lot of those same cards. I added another very good babyface in June, Tommy Sigler. I don't know how much you know about Tommy Sigler, but he was a very underrated talent, I thought. In July, I was set to add heel superstars Jody Hamilton, the original assassin, and Rock Hunter. I was also going to have a look at a new heel tag team in July called the Outlaws, Ken Dillinger and Cowboy Parker. And in August, I had already set up to bring in a great heel team, Kurt and Carl Von Steiger, along with the veteran heel of Frank Morrell. And also in August, I'm going to bring in my brother. He's going to be coming back for some appearances. He hasn't been there since his last Knoxville appearance in the Third Coliseum show on April 27, 75. So I'm not dead in the water here. I'm dealing with a lot of good talent, and I'm setting things up, anticipating that something may happen with Jarrett. If it does, I don't want to be left high and dry, basically.
Had you already made an arrangement by this period of time with your brother, with Robert, for when he would come in?
No. No, he's still working for he's working on the Memphis side of the state, and he's working for two territories, basically. He's working some for Nick, and some nights he works for Jarrett, and then occasionally he's available for me to use him on a Friday night. At this point, I don't have a territory. I basically have a weekend situation. I got Knoxville on Friday. I try to run a small town like Morristown or Middlesboro, Kentucky, something like that on a Saturday. But I don't have a full-time crew, and I don't have enough towns at this point to put guys to work and to get guys to come in, the quality guys, and stay for me. But we're not that far away. Now we're on a television station that's going to give us the ability to get to a whole lot of different people. And, for one city operation, I'm dealing with some really great talent, actually. You know, I knew we were now reaching a quarter of a million new potential viewers each week that all lived outside the old station signal. That's a phenomenal figure. When you got 250,000 people that are now going to get wrestling that have never seen it, that is a tremendous potential audience here. And by the end of the summer, we'd have 3 months of exposure in an additional 20 to 30 new small cities that had never had live wrestling matches in them. So hopefully by then we would be able to start thinking about running lots of those towns. And when that happens, we will be operating at least 5 nights a week. And when you can get in that 5-night, 6-night a week area, then you start becoming a territory. Now, all of a sudden, you can get guys to come and work for you. They want to live there, and you can make them enough money to keep them, make them happy.
That's where you would be by the end of the summer. Did you anticipate that already at this point in May? Did you see that happening so quickly that you'd be able to expand into more cities?
Well, I did. I did see that the potential for it being able to happen. I knew that's why I wanted to go to WBIR. I recognized and realized that their signal was so strong that it's going to give me the opportunity to reach fans out there that had never actually had a chance to see quality wrestling before. So I felt like we were going to be headed in that direction. And later on in this program, I'm going to talk to you about why it didn't happen. You know, and that's kind of strange, but it didn't happen as quickly as I wanted to. So, you know, let's just change gears here for a little bit. As we promised at the beginning of the show today, I said we'd take a few minutes to talk about the recent lawsuit I received from the incident, obviously, with Dale Lewis and that $1,000 challenge match on the night of March 28, 1975, in which Danny Hodge got involved. And you know, so the last episode, I got delivered the papers for a lawsuit for $100,000. It was a new experience for me, and I wasn't sure where to turn for help. I had an attorney. When I first started doing these challenge matches with Dale Lewis, I found myself an attorney, and I said, I need to have a whole harmless agreement that would allow my wrestler to wrestle people from the audience and cover me. Well, you know, he gave me a little small agreement called a whole harmless agreement, and that all challengers had to sign before they entered the ring for these challenge matches. It basically said that the challenger was aware he was engaging in a potentially dangerous physical altercation with a professional athlete, and that any injuries sustained in the course of these matches would not be covered by Southeastern Wrestling or the wrestler involved and would be the responsibility of the individual. Well, he's got to risk something. If he has $1,000 to gain, you know, he may get hurt in trying to gain it and trying to win it. That kind of covers you in some respects. And further states that those injuries, if any, to the wrestler involved will be paid for by Southeastern. I'm going to pay the wrestler. If you hurt my wrestler, I'm going to take care of his injuries. And then if you get hurt yourself by the wrestler, you'll be responsible to take care of your own injuries. I thought this was going to protect me. I already had at least $2,000 in payments each month for Knoxville. What's that figure, Brian? You're good at calculating that quickly.
What did you say,
$2,000 a month. What is that in 1975? What is kind of money is that by today's standards?
In 1975, $2,000 is in 2019. Wow. In 2019, $9,522.
All right. So that's my payments for Knoxville, basically. And then I'm looking at the potential for even more, much more to be spent on this, on the lawsuit, because the attorney fees at least are going to be added to my current bills, so that $2,000 a month. And then if there's a judgment, and whatever that judgment figure is added in on top of that, this weighs heavily on my mind constantly because it's the first lawsuit I've ever had, and I had no idea what this was going to involve before it was all finished. Well, we're going to come back to this story of the $100,000 lawsuit quite often here until we get to the resolving it in the weeks ahead. So, I'm looking forward to getting into more of that. And, the $9,500, that's a fantastic figure right there. And it's for a young boy, 27 years old, and trying to get his company off the ground, and having that kind of responsibility, and now having this lawsuit on top of all of that, it's really a lot for me as a young man to be able to keep my head on straight.
Well, Ron, that seems like a really good place to take our break, and let's do so right now. Let's hear a word about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 19, where the Tennessee Stud gets down and dirty with Dutch Mantel.
Fans around the world know what fascinating characters professional wrestlers are. The Stud has introduced us to many of them in his Deep Dive Super Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Number 19 introduces another personal friend of Ron's, as are all that he covers in these classic Super Studcast. This one was the very first to join the Stud when he became the youngest wrestling promoter in the world. He had not only the wrestling ability to be a star, but he was also a star on the microphone. His career was long and filled with success. This time, the Stud is going to get down and dirty with the one and only Dutch Mantel. Super Studcast, with each new release, are the hottest wrestling podcast on the planet. And this one is a must listen as these two friends for 44 years tell the stories that will become memories for fans around the world. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. There is no better way to spend 3 hours than riding down the historic road of this great sport's past. Saddle up for the unforgettable.
There you hear it once again, the latest Super Studcast number 19 with Dirty Dutch Mantel. This is a memorable episode of the Super Studcast, the latest installment in what has become such a popular series for patrons of the Studcast. Of course, you can access this show as well as every single Super Studcast with Wrestlers like Terry Funk, Stan Hansen, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, Ron Garvin, Kevin Sullivan, Tommy Rich, and so many more, as well as some of the deep dives into history like the Atlanta War, the Knoxville War, and so much more by going to tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. You get in the door. It is the best deal in wrestling. And from there, Ron, let's get back to the Studcast. We'll have more information about the Super Studcast at the end of the program. What do you got in store for the fans for Friday, May 30th in Knoxville?
Okay, we're back in the amphitheater at Chihuahua Park. Hopefully it's not going to rain. If it does, we've got that indoor arena, but we're looking for really nice nights. It would be beautiful if it happened all summer long. We're set to... And then we're going to talk about the card, and then we'll set up the TV based upon that card. I think that's a good way for us to be able to do this, and you can kind of understand then why the matches on the TV are what they are, and all of it leads to this card of May the 30th. The opening match is a barn burner on the May the 30th, featuring two great wrestlers, Carl Von Steiger, making his first ever appearance for Southeastern, is going to wrestle Ricky Gibson in the first match. Another one of those situations at the first match I absolutely love. Wow, I know these guys are going to go out there. They're going to wrestle, and then they're going to get a little bit crazy, and they're going to give the fans exactly what they need for that first match. And like I said, to me, it's a perfect first match. And they go out there and do just exactly that. I didn't want to hurt either one of those guys at this point. It's Carl Von Steiger's first night. He's going to have his brother coming in later in the summer. And they're going to be the top tag team. And I certainly didn't want to hurt Ricky at this point. So obviously this ends up in a 20-minute draw. And these two guys, these are top stars in the summer ahead, both of them, Ricky Gibson and Carl Von Steiger, and his brother when he gets there as well. The second and third matches are going to be double duty again for the Mongolian Stomper. I loved what happened the week before. I liked how he got over by winning twice back to back. And in the first match, he goes out there and stomps himself another head, and it happens to be DeVoy Brunson, poor old DeVoy Brunson. In this first match, and then he attacks the crowd again, just like he had done the week before. And you would have thought the fans wouldn't react the same way as the week before. They had seen it. Maybe they're not going to be as afraid or whatever, but boy, that was certainly not true. I think it was maybe more profound for him on the second time that he did it than he did the week before. And his focus was again on the ringsiders after the first match. And then he went right back to the general admissions grandstand after the second match, in which he worked with George McCrae. Obviously, Stomper wins both of these matches. And I was just really amazed at how fast this guy was getting over. I mean, you could just feel it from the audience that they were buying big time the old Archie Goldie, man. They were really into Archie.
Did you already at this period of time envision a future for him full time in the territory? What would become the territory, I should say?
I wanted him. He was one of those guys. I went and watched his matches and I saw the reaction of the crowd and I knew how fast he was getting over. And he's the type of guy you want in your territory. And I wanted him. I'm not going to get him for a while. It's going to be a while before he does come. But once he comes, the great part of it is he never leaves. And I get the use of that human. Wow, he's a monster. And what great, great matches we're going to have with everybody he goes in the ring with. I wanted him very badly. I'm not going to be able to get him yet, but I am going to get him down the line. Fourth match on that card was based on the last 3 weeks with me against either of the two Wrights by myself or involved in an 8-man tag with them. So I've had 3 weeks now. Once I wrestled the Wright brothers, both of them in a handicap match. Now I'm in an 8-man tag the last week. And this time I was bringing the beast with me, man. I'm bringing the man, Jody Hamilton, the original assassin. I'm bringing him in for his first time ever for Southeastern as a partner to take on the Wrights. It's actually, I think, his first time ever in Knoxville. And, you know, the assassin, in a way, is another stomper. I mean, he just looks the part, man. And so this was his first Southeastern appearance. And his size, his speed for a big man, and his downright nastiness when he needed it, was just a shock to Knoxville fans. This was the beginning of a long run for me and him as tag partners. The fans are going to detest the huge masked man as we wrestled many combinations of teams throughout that summer. They're going to get to hate the assassin. And gosh, Jody is he's a scary individual too. He's very similar to Archie. I mean, doesn't look like him at all, but they both have that same style in which fans just really get into it and they buy them. They're the real thing, basically. The main event that night is going to be Ron and Don Bass with their manager, Sam Bass, against Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett. And this time, it's all on the line, as the Basses are going to put up their Tennessee Tag Championship belts against the hair of both the opponents, Golden and Jarrett's. The belt's going to go to the winner, and if Golden and Jarrett lose, they're going to shave their heads, both of them, after the match. And this was kind of like an all or nothing risk for Golden and Jarrett, and an obvious end to the program for weeks these two teams have been facing each other. You know, you can't go much further than this. You've got the titles versus the hair, and it's going to be a wild affair there. And actually, what's going to happen is Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett are going to come out of there with those titles. So. So it's now time to set up the TV show. Now we know what the card is. And once I got the card put together, and this is the way bookers normally work, is they put the card together and then they put the television together. The television is all designed and set to promote the card. So this card, I just gave you the card. And now I'm going to give you how I decided to really piece it together on the television show to get the most out of it when they started selling tickets on the following Friday night. I'd recorded several matches, obviously, from the show before, as we'd been doing, and interviews from the Friday night, the preceding Friday night, that eight-man tag wild affair. Stomper's two victories, his first two, the rampage through the crowd, an interview with Bearcat Wright because he wasn't available for TV, nor was Stomper available for that TV. There's also an interview going to be done with Jerry Jarrett and Jimmy Golden because Jerry Jarrett is not going to be available for that TV. Both my Southern title match with Ricky Gibson is on there from the week before, and the incident with Jimmy Golden that took place. And that leads into the eight-man tag, all of it. So we recorded a heck of a lot of this particular night. We're going to have to be careful about how much we show. I mean, you don't want to hurt yourself by giving people the idea that, well, I can just stay here and watch it on TV and I'll be able to see the show too. So you give them enough just to tease them, basically. So we open the TV show with the new assassin on live. His first day there, he hasn't even actually wrestled yet in Chihuahua Park or in Knoxville, but he's going to be on that show. I thought that was a great opportunity I had when I brought Jody in early and said, can you work the TV before working the first event? And that always makes a difference. And I sat in on the match with Les, and obviously I sold the immense and dangerous partner that I was going to release on the Wright brothers the following Friday night. And that's what's on that card. We're going to go after the Wrights. After the commercial break, Ron and Don Wright had their say about the upcoming tag, and they really put the assassin over. Since fans were not familiar with him, you know, I talked to Ron about it. He's going to do most of the talking, and he got the picture right away, you know, and he went out and sold how tough and how famous this guy was and how brutal he was and why they called him the assassin and the whole deal. So the interview was more serious with the Wright boys than it was usual, and they focused on that dangerous rival that I had aligned myself with. There was really no humor in this interview, especially as it had been the case on the other station with old Big Jim. This would have been a laughable affair, and they would have sold it totally wrong, in which you can't sell tickets by getting your people to laugh all the time. It's got to have a serious component to it, and this one did. So this was two very serious opponents for them, and the Wright boys really sold that well.
Speaking of Big Jim Hess, I'm just curious, did Les Thatcher and Phil Rainey, were they comfortable right away? Were you happy with their performance as your commentators right away, or did it take them some time to get their footing?
They were like professionals that had been doing it all their lives. I mean, Les was so good at it. I could not believe that he had not worked as a commentator before. He might have for over there in the Charlotte area, in the Carolinas, from Mid-Atlantic. But he was so good at it. And Phil Rainey, the second guy who is the announcer, he fit very well with Les. He wasn't very knowledgeable about the sport. As time grows by, he's going to be great too. But his comments are very good. He's very serious. There's no Big Jim Hess element in this show on WBIR. None whatsoever. And everything on here is serious. And that's exactly what I was looking for.
Did you have any issues moving to the new studio with getting fans to show up for TV tapings at a new studio?
No, because obviously what you do is that first Friday night before we were on that, did the first show, we explained to the fans during the course of that entire night, probably announced it seven times, that here's how you can come to the studio, where it's located, here's what time to be there, only be limited to only 200 or whatever number it was of people that we could put in there. And we never, even from the very first show, ever had a television program that we did not have to turn away fans. We could never get them all in there. So they would start lining up. That show started at 11:30. They would start lining up there at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was crazy. You'd drive up to that studio and at nine, I'd get there and I'm 2.5 hours early and there'd be 15, 20 people in line already that's going to stand there. And a lot of times that's in snow and ice and bad weather, or rain, whatever it is. They came prepared to see the show and great fans in that part of the country. So second TV match is going to be the Tennessee Tag Champions, Ron and Don Bass, versus a couple of really unlucky job boys. Because the Basses, I sat with Ron, who is kind of the leader of that group, Ron Bass, and they explained, Ron, I really want you guys to start doing more, and I want you to really start kicking some butt here. And they really went out and took care of the two job boys they had. I told them to be more vicious than they had been, and they got the message, and I watched it, and I was like, wow, Ron was listening. So Jimmy Golden sat in with Les Thatcher for this one because he's going to be wrestling them. They surrounded Jimmy. After the match, they get out. They win real strong. They get out, and they get on three sides of Jimmy, and Jimmy's at the set with Les. And it looks like a situation, if it had been the old show, they were going to jump him. There would have been a fight. There would have been something happened there that probably shouldn't have happened. And I didn't want it to happen that way. So they surrounded him, and Jimmy's by himself because Jared is not on the show. And just about the time that it looks like they're going to get on top of him, out comes Ricky Gibson, who had helped the week before. Now Ricky comes out to back Jimmy up. And then Les took over, which I really loved it. And he just demanded that the three of the Basses leave the set. And I loved the fact that Les took control of the show. And the fans, I wanted the fans to realize that this was not going to be an out of control atmosphere on this television show as it had been at the old one. Jimmy and Ricky stood their ground. Les backed the Bass Trio off with a very direct explanation of his control in the future. It's like, this is not just the first time, gentlemen. This is not going to happen on this program. You know, I really loved the way he sold it. And so Jimmy and Ricky stood the ground, like I said. And after the commercial break, we returned to the set again for the Basses' opportunity to have their say about the main event the next Friday with their belts against the hair of Golden and Jarrett. And before they started, Let's introduce the quick interview we had shot the Friday before with Golden and Jarrett while they were in Knoxville. And Sam took over after their words, and they showed the specially produced photos. I love this. I don't know where they got these made, but they found photos of Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett, and they had somebody take their hair off, and they were bald-headed. And they showed those photos. They went, "Now, just in case you don't come next Friday, we want to show you what these guys are going to look like after that match." And they put those photos up, and they took shots of them with the camera. And, you know, it was a huge, and they got a huge laugh, the three of them, the Basses. They really enjoyed that little piece. And you know, the old adage, a picture is worth a thousand words, was never more appropriate. I can tell you that, man. Those two pictures, just, I was in the control room. I mean, I just freaked out. I laughed my butt off like they did. Like, wow, this is good, man. So that whole segment, that second segment to me rocked. It was really good.
How do you follow that segment up then, Ron? What's the next segment?
Well, after every the program has a format. It's four matches. It's two matches. In the middle is the personality profile and two final matches. So we're in the personality profile segment. And it was going to be a great one because it was the Assassin's first time ever to wrestle on the show. So it made sense to give him that five-minute personality profile segment to introduce himself. Les did a super job of questioning him about his history and his championships that he and Tom Ernesto had held, and they were huge numbers of them. And Hamilton went along for about 3 minutes. And then kept his focus on Friday night's card as my partner, you know. Hey, and he had some good things to say about me. And there was always a very serious side to Jody Hamilton. And this personality profile exposed that to everybody. It became very clear. Starts off nice and, you know, well, I was here and I did this and I did that. But he always had a way of not raising his voice, but really captivating his audience. And fans, I don't know if they did for them what it did for me, but at the end of this personality profile, he starts really into, you know, the Wright brothers and you know, the history of these guys, and I've heard about them and all of that. And I got goosebumps in the control room, and I don't know if the fans at home did, but I mean, he really chilled me. You know, I was like, wow, man, this is a heck of a personality profile. So, you know, we got a great wrestling show going at this point. Third segment's going to open with a big win for Ricky Gibson in a live match, obviously. And he's followed, he was followed at the set by the taping of the two back-to-back matches of the back-to-back wins with the Mongolian Stomper from the Friday before. That's going to show him rampaging wildly through the crowd, and the crowd just going crazy and running from him. And Thatcher and Phil Rainey both covered these two matches, and they made great comments about the fear imposed on the crowd by the man from Mongolia. After the commercial break, Les called for an interview that Bearcat Wright had done the Friday before about his Stomper. Once again, taking on two opponents the next Friday, he alluded to the fact he might not be able to control the Stomper as he had done the week before, and he might just allow him to run crazy in that amphitheater and do whatever he wanted to in there, and then maybe go to the dressing room when Stomper wins and just see how many people he can destroy in the crowd. I mean, you know, it's like crazy talk, but it got over. Great interview. Nice third segment. Got a show that's really rolling along good at that point.
So how do you end that show that's rolling along so good? How do you stop the ball from rolling?
Well, you keep her rolling, really. You got her rolling at this point. I put the Wright boys on TV. I mean, you know, they've been there for years and years. They are the baby faces in that part of the country, and I'm going to give them a great win there live, and then I'm going to send them to the set after that, and they're going to watch that eight-man tag from the prior Friday night, that crazy affair that really never had a proper introduction and never got the bell rung properly, that ended up in disqualification, and that continued as the fighting. He just kept going. So they talked about the Assassin that had been on the show, and what the world thought of this guy. They really put Jody over, which was really great. I mean, Ron Bass, really good. And when I talked to him about what I wanted, he really captured it, man. And they predicted a win for Golden and Jarrett in the Hair versus title match. And they reminded the fans how long this had been brewing between Jarrett and Golden and the Basses. They covered at least the top two matches for the next card, and they left the crowd really into it. After the commercial break, the Assassin and I, we get our interview time. We go and join Les at the set, and we talk about the end of the Wright brother era in Tennessee, how old these guys are, and how young and tough we are, how we had all the wrestling skills, and they were just a bunch of East Tennessee brawlers. How they had ruled the roost in East Tennessee for a long, long time, and the Wrights' day was done. It was the end was coming for them. And the more we got into them, the louder the crowd protested in the studio. I mean, they were booing us like crazy. It was a good ending to a great show, and I was excited with the prospects for the next Friday night.
Well, Ron, we are getting close to the end of this episode of the Studcast, but you mentioned at the top of the show that there were a couple other things you wanted to discuss that you've never discussed before here on the show.
Yeah, Brian, yeah, I did. You know, and I'd like to do something that I've never done on any Studcast so far. I've talked about everything over the last 2 years, and that reminds me, this is episode 104, and that's exactly 2 years ago that I did my very first Studcast. I believe that there is a story in every life that sometimes gets left out. And, you know, this is my life story on every Studcast. I give my all to remember as much and tell as much as I can about myself and my family. I don't think I should tell just the wrestling part of my life and leave out the rest. I'm going to take us in an entirely new direction. And maybe in podcast terms, what I'm about to get into is just not done. I want to talk about my personal life in this 1975 time frame because it's going to play a large role in the future of my business, my Southeastern company, and where my head is as a young man. And I know that this, to some fans, may not be wrestling related, but what's going on at our home and our lives has a great bearing on what's going on, period, in our life. And in 1975, I've got all of these things that are really driving me nuts. I've got the lawsuit. I've got these payments for my company. I have talent that I have to go search for. I have finishes and guys to deal with. So I want to talk a little bit about what's actually happening in my personal life in this time frame. And in order to do that, I want to back up a little bit and just kind of cover my marriage. I'd been married since 1970 when I graduated from college and I started wrestling. The first 2 years of my marriage, I was wrestling in one territory at a time. That's difficult enough for a marriage, no matter what your occupation is. But wrestlers have a history of problems that arise from being in the sport. Just being a wrestler is tough for wives. Really, really difficult. You're not at home as much as a normal job, obviously, and you're never at home at night. And when I began in Georgia, my first territory, I was home every night after wrestling. When me and my wife moved to Florida, I was gone on lots of weekends to either the Bahamas or to Puerto Rico. When I got home, I was always tired. My wife was not so tired, and she was obviously eager for my company because I'd spent so much time alone. This absence over a period of time tends obviously to create some problems for the man, for the husband and the wife. The wife is lonelier, I think, because she's mostly by herself. And as a wrestler, you're always around the boys and you're never really by yourself. So to be quite honest, there was always a female fan hanging around the matches as well. It's a part of the business. And this is a part of the story of not just the sport of wrestling, But I'm sure all major sports, it doesn't happen for just wrestling. You go baseball and basketball and football. Sports, you know, draws attention, and there are always opportunities to get yourself into something that you shouldn't be into. All wives knew about it, and it broke up a whole lot of homes. Just the business itself and being part of it as a wrestler. And April of 1971, my first son was born. Obviously, that kept my wife busier after that, made her happier to have something to do. In the fall of 72, our second son was born, and everything was pretty darn good in my home. Now, I'm living at that point. I've gone from Tampa, and I'm living in West Palm. And now maybe she had too much time on her hands. My being on the road and gone so much, it provided her no break from raising my two sons totally by herself. She was handling these two young boys by herself almost all the time. I was going everywhere. In 1973, it gets worse, as we've covered in prior studcasts. I get hooked up in St. Louis, and I start going to St. Louis every other weekend, for sure. And then I leave on Friday mornings for those trips, and I don't come back until Sunday night. Things begin to unravel in 73 a little bit. We start to have problems over this huge workload I have, which is basically 7 nights a week. And I, looking back at some of my charts the other day, as much as 330 days a year in the ring. In 1974, when I get to Knoxville to start Southeastern, she remained in West Palm, where we owned a home. Had a house down there. She came. We separated. We had an agreement and we separated. And I went to Knoxville by myself, found myself an apartment. She stayed in West Palm Beach. And obviously, we were growing further apart. Within a month of my arrival in Knoxville, we talked and agreed to sell the Florida home. And she and the boys joined me to try to make it in Knoxville. She'd left the University of Miami when we met. That's where we met, in the University of Miami, and she was a year short of graduation. When she came to Knoxville and brought the boys, she wanted to get her degree, University of Tennessee. Made sense. Great college right there in Knoxville. I was home a lot because I was only working Mondays in those times and in Memphis and the weekends in Knoxville and near home. Things began to get better. She was happier with studying, and I was, for the first time, able to help more with the boys. In the summer of 1975, where we are talking about now, she was close to her degree and involved in a class that required her to work on an archaeological dig in an American Indian area close to Nashville that they were building a big dam, and they were going to cover all that area. They wanted to find artifacts and relics of American Indian culture prior to damming this place up and building a lake that's going to cover all that ground. She needed the credits to graduate. Then she wanted to attend law school after she graduated there at the University of Tennessee. This put a real strain on me because I wanted to spend time with my family. But she would then be on the road with my sons from Monday until Friday every week at this archaeological dig. She's going to actually go out there and dig up the artifacts with a group of students from the university. So my company's doing fairly well at this point. I'm off to a pretty decent start. And I knew the TV station was going to take a while before the potential audience is going to find us. So that fact, along with what was happening to her, led me away from my new company and toward trying to retain my marriage. I agreed to put my company's interest in the background and spend each week with my family on that archaeological dig. I became an archaeologist. I started digging just like she did Monday through Friday that entire summer of 1975. It affected me greatly in so many ways. It affected, obviously, my income. It affected my company. It affected my future. But I felt it was worth it. It was like the ultimate sacrifice to keep my family life together. Obviously, I wasn't in tune with my business as I needed to be. That summer of 75 is going to be the worst financially of my career, my wrestling career. I'm going to make less money than I'd ever made. Knoxville did not do as well as it should have because it took a while for that TV change to crank in. And I wasn't as focused on opening small cities that I could have been to add to my income. So in the fall of 75, she enrolls in law school, become interested in, and she becomes interested in somebody else. She meets somebody else. So we stay together during the spring of 76, and she moves out during the spring of 76 with our sons. And soon afterwards, she files for divorce, and she's awarded alimony and child support of $1,500 a month. How much is that?
If we're going to go based on what we did earlier, $1,975, $1,500 a month would be approximately $7,141.
Oh, there's my alimony.
Wow. So
now I've got the lawsuit. I've got the payments to Kazana of $9,500 a month, and I've got $7,140 or $7,7100 or so to her and taking care of my kids. I've got some a pretty huge overhead here,
yeah.
And I'm not really focused on my business. So as I saw it afterward, I'd wasted a summer and fall that I could have been growing my company. But to me at that time, my family was more important. I wanted to make every attempt to save my family that I could. And I'm not sure why it seems important for me to go into all this. But this is my life story here. This studcast is my life story. And I don't think I should leave out something as important as this because it is part of the story.
I think it's really important that you include this stuff. And I think it's a real benefit to the show and to the progress of the show that you would consider including this in the show. I have one last question before we wrap things up, Ron. When it comes to your young sons, and obviously they're very young at this period of time, but you are a wrestling star. In East Tennessee, they have the last name Welch, but your last name is Fuller. But they see you, I'm sure, on TV. Do you smarten them up? How does that work?
No. You know, really funny about smartening people up. I was never very good at it. you know, and it was because my dad never smartened my brother and I up until we were in high school. You know, and because the wrestling was so different in that time frame, it was believable. I mean, everything you saw, you really believed, you know, and I remember that Rob, Dad tried to smarten him up and Rob wouldn't. He was like, no, Dad, that can't be real. That can't be true. You know, and I remember that. In Miami one time when I was in college, Rob was there with my dad, and my dad went to Sputnik, was on that card, and he says, take Rob back there in the dressing room and smarten him up. And so Sputnik takes Rob in the dressing room. I didn't go back. I wasn't privy to the conversation, but I was already smart at that point. But Rob just wasn't going to buy it. He wasn't going to believe it. And Sputnik lays it all out here, and here's what's going on, and here's what it all is, kid. And he finished, and Rob said, bullshit. Got up, walked out. And I remember Dad finding Munro, and he said, well, how did it go? And he goes, I don't know. He goes, the kid's nuts, man. He won't listen to me. So, you know, I didn't smarten people up. I never smarted up my wives. It was, you know, you just didn't do it. I guess I had such respect for the business, and I waited so long in my life to be smartened up that I just didn't. I couldn't do it. I couldn't tell people about it, and I wouldn't tell people, not even my own family members as close as my wife. So it's just really crazy, but that's a fact.
Okay, one last question now that you opened this door. Did any of your wives ever get mad after the fact that you didn't smarten them up?
Yes, the first one got a little bit angry about it. Yes, she got a little bit upset about it because somebody else smartened her up.
Oh.
You know? Yeah, I mean, she was going to matches some, and I didn't take her to a lot of matches back in those days. But she went somewhere, and some guy got her off the side, and she probably said, boy, he got hurt and such, and then he laid it all out there. And, boy, she was a little upset. She goes, how come you didn't tell me all this? You know, it was maybe a bad thing. I had a second wife, and I had a car tournament in Mobile, Alabama, and probably, I'm going to say 1982, for a beautiful – Nissan's 280Z, beautiful car. And I won the tournament, and I was wrestling against a Mongolian Stomper, and the car was parked in the back of the building, back of the arena. And Stomper lost the match, and while I'm in the ring, I'm still selling. He goes to the back of the arena and grabs one of those big old steel stanchions, and he's going to throw it through the windshield of this beautiful, brand new, expensive damn car. And my wife is up on the stage above where the car is sitting down below her, and she sees him pick up the stanchion, and she realizes that he's going to throw it through the windshield, and she jumps off on his back. And in a big arena, and I mean, there's hundreds of fans there. They're trying to keep him from destroying the car, and she's on his back. He's fighting her off, trying to get her off his back so that he can do the deal, so he can slam this thing through the windshield. It's like, so it didn't work out always for me that I didn't smart them up, but I just never liked to do it. I never wanted to smart up anybody.
Well, Ron, before we wrap things up here this week, a few notes. Of course, we want to remind everyone on Facebook, the page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. All you have to do is like that page, and instantly you are friends with the Tennessee Stud. Of course, you can follow the Stud on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And of course, you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We mentioned it earlier. Part one of Super Studcast number 19 is now available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Of course, Super Studcast number 19 is a down and dirty edition featuring Dirty Dutch Mantel. This is a fantastic episode, if I say so myself. Here, the Tennessee Stud and the Dirty Dutchman go back and forth, share memories and laughs and so much more. Hear this show today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week on the Studcast?
Well, before I answer that, I'd like to throw in my two cents here about old Dirty Dutch myself, you know.
Okay.
You know, I really enjoyed the heck out of this part one, you know, and we covered so many different topics. I never realized how much Dutch had been around since 75 when he started working for me, and I really enjoyed that episode as well. And I think if fans are into the Super Studcast, I think this is one they're definitely going to want to hear. Next week, we're going to go back to Red Hot Memphis. I mean, Memphis is still cranked. I'm still there every Monday, and it is doing phenomenal business. I'm going to be entering probably the last month of my run as a Southern Heavyweight Champion over there in the Memphis area. What I talked about earlier in this show that may develop with Jarrett is about to take place. We're racing into Southeastern's first summer in Knoxville. And we're going to find out how I'm going to use some of the great talent I've got and that I've mentioned already in this show. We're going to continue to deal with that $100,000 Challenger lawsuit. And we may even open up some eyes to the findings of an archaeological dig, man. We're liable to get into everything, man. We're going to do a little bit of everything.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll see if the Tennessee Studs are real Indiana Jones or not, but that will be next week on the Studcast. Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.